An investigative reporter with the Wall Street Journal, Jonathan Quitney, concluded recently after a six-month investigation that some of the drug allegations have merit, but some of the traffickers' stories are undocumented or implausible in important details. The Senate Narcotics Panel and the House Judiciary Subcommittee on Crime are pursuing the issue. The evidence gathered so far substantiates allegations that Contras and other leaders... The evidence gathered so far substantiates allegations that Contras and the Contra leadership have been involved in drug trafficking, unquote, Representative Edward Feigin, or Fagan, F-E-I-G-H-A-N, Democrat of Ohio, said recently. We've found some fairly disturbing links in Contra drug trafficking, alleged CIA complicity, and possible obstruction of justice in the Justice Department, unquote. According to published reports, U.S. approval for Israeli arms sales to Iran came not in 1985, but in early 1981. That was shortly after Reagan took office, and a time when there were no American hostages in Iran or in Lebanon. Moshe Arens, then Israeli ambassador to the United States, told the Boston Globe in 1982 that such sales were being coordinated with officials at the top of the Reagan administration. In an effort to explain these early sales, some investigators have looked to the 1980 presidential campaign. The Reagan campaign had spies in the Carter administration, according to a 1984 congressional investigation of the Republican nominee's acquisition of a confidential debate briefing book prepared for Carter. The Reagan intelligence network was led by William Casey, who had become deeply involved in the Contra support operation as director of Central Intelligence. The campaign's top foreign policy advisor was Richard Allen, who became Reagan's first national security advisor. Campaign aides wanted to find out about any October surprise, unquote, involving the release of the hostages from the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, who were held captive through the last year of Carter's presidency. Abul Hassan Bani Sadra, who was then president of Iran, has said that Allen and two other Reagan campaign officials made a deal with Iranian representatives in early October of 1980. Iran would get future arms deliveries in exchange for refusing to release the hostages while Carter was president. Allen and another Reagan campaign representative at the meeting, the future National Security Advisor Robert McFarlane, deny any deal was struck. But Barbara Honegger, a Reagan campaign aide, has said that in late October of 1980, another staffer told her, quote, "We don't have to worry about an October surprise. Dick," meaning Dick Allen, "cut a deal." The hostages were released on Reagan's inauguration day in January of 1981. The Iran-Contra report disposes of the issue in one footnote, quote, "The committees were told that the Iranian approaches were rejected and have found no credible evidence to suggest that any discussions were held or agreements reached on delaying the release of the hostages or arranging an early arms for hostages deal. No official investigations are known to be pursuing the issue." Well, again, we've spoken about each of the issues raised in this particular article in our other five parts of the series. We're not going to take those up now. We refer people to RFAs numbers 29 through 33 for various aspects of this. What we're going to do for the duration of the broadcast is take a look at why none of these things was gone into.
That's right, and why exactly. The Examiner's remains one of the few good overview articles that's been written on the thing, and why the stuff they talk about came as such shocking news to so many of the public, despite the fact that this stuff is right out there on the trees to be plucked. Meanwhile, before we get to that portion of the broadcast, we're going to take a short break for a few minutes and give everybody a chance to stretch and bend and walk around and shake their heads ruefully, wondering what this world is coming to. And Free America, what we're doing tonight is the final for now and sixth part of our Iran-Contra series. We have, as we mentioned at the beginning of the show, last month we did mostly strange deaths and break-ins, and this month we are doing bizarre stratagems and funky appointments, I guess is the way that we might phrase it. And at the beginning of the broadcast, we were updating some portion of materials from some new things about the Iran-Contra case that have come up, namely some new links between Henry Arsin of DEA informant and head of STBOM, who is also a prime player in the Mediterranean merry-go-round case, is now linked to the current case that we've been talking about, the Italian-Iran-Gate case, and we talked about links between Licio Gelli, Grandmaster of the P2, former Oberleutnant in the SS, and his alleged, according to his own references, his great friendship with George Bush and the protection that he has gained from that friendship, despite the fact that he is an international fugitive with warrants on his head all over the place. And we talked about a variety of other things. And now we ended up with an article that Dave read from the San Francisco Examiner by Lewis Traeger talking about the fact that the Iran-Contra Committee, and before that the Tower Commission, despite all of their deliberations and their voluminous records that they then put out at the end of these deliberations, basically talked not at all about some of the most important issues, namely the connections between the Contra supply movement and cocaine dealing, between the Contra supply effort and assassination attempts, between the Contra supply effort and a variety of other international arms and drug scandals, and things of that nature. And just as we talked about how one of the ways in which this information has not come out has been due to the fact that a lot of the witnesses have suddenly fell down dead, we're going to talk tonight about some other reasons that perhaps a lot of this information has not yet reached the public ear.
Now, again, we're going to be taking a look at a series of connections between various people in charge with investigating, or apparently investigating, one aspect or another of the Iran-Contra scandal, and those who were involved apparently in perpetrating that very same scandal. So hang on to your hats. We would like to say that some of these connections may be speculative. In other words, we can't say for sure that every one of these connections is absolutely hard. However, we're offering them up for your examination. Many of them, we feel, are very, very hard connections indeed. However, some of them should belong in our category of food for thought, grounds for further research.
We also mentioned at the beginning of the show, I took joking exception to Dave's reference of a fox guarding the hen house, and rephrased it myself as a phalanx of foxes guarding a subdivision of hen houses. And as you will see as we go through the broadcast tonight, that virtually every avenue of investigation into the Iran-Contra case has found itself headed up or internally compromised in some way by having some key part of the operation being done by somebody who themselves have ties to the very people being investigated.
It may be that the foxes who are watching the hen houses may account for some of the foul play that we've been seeing.
Oh, dear.
You didn't think you'd get through a whole show without me throwing at least one rotten pun, did you?
I had hopes, but I suppose it was too much to wish for. Anyway, we're going to read an article that was supplied to us by Mae Brussel. The article is from the New York Times for January 23rd, 1987. The article is headlined, "A Senate Panel on Iran Names New York Lawyer as Counsel." The article is by David E. Rosenbaum, is a special to the New York Times, Dateline, Washington. A New York City criminal lawyer who has represented many prominent public figures and directed several government inquiries was named today to be chief counsel of the special Senate committee investigating the Iran-Contra affair. I shall just put in parenthetically here that, of course, this is the same Senate panel headed by Daniel Inouye, whose hearings and their consideration of this case have just come out and, as we mentioned, have discussed virtually nothing having to do with assassination, drug dealing, or the real nitty-gritty of the Iran-Contra case. The lawyer, Arthur L. Lyman, L-I-M-A-N, age 54, was an assistant United States attorney in New York in the 1960s and is now a partner in the law firm of Paul Weiss Rifkind, Wharton, and Garrison. Mr. Rifkind is going to be interesting. We'll get back to that. His specialty is white-collar crime. Among his clients have been John A. Zaccaro, the real estate developer and husband of Geraldine Ferraro, the Democratic candidate for vice president in 1984. Other clients have included Stephen J. Ross, chairman of Warner Communications, Robert L. Vesco, the financier who is a fugitive from justice, and Dennis B. Levine, the former Drexel Burnham merger executive who pleaded guilty last year to insider trading. Mr. Lyman also represented Carl C. Icahn, the corporate raider, in his attempted takeover of the Phillips Petroleum Company. He also headed Governor Nelson A. Rockefeller's commission that investigated the Attica prison riot in 1971, Governor Hugh L. Carey's commission on sentencing, Governor Cuomo's advisory committee on the administration of justice, and Mayor Koch's investigation of allegations of wrongdoing by the city's medical examiner, Elliot Gross. Now, a couple of things to be mentioned really quickly. In the Lewis Traeger article from The Examiner, one of the things that was mentioned was that the committee viewed the Iran-Contra scandal almost entirely as a case of pretty low-level white-collar crimes. That was the only take that they had on it. It's interesting that it looks like from the word go, they brought in a lawyer His other connections aside, and we'll talk about that in a moment, whose only expertise or whose main expertise was in white-collar crime, not somebody with any expertise in the field of uncovering intelligence operations. Now, if that was not enough, however, Mr. Lyman is also rather doubtful in some other ways, not least among them his involvement as a lawyer for Robert Vesco. Robert Vesco, for our purposes, is a man of he's a Renaissance man of the extreme right, the bizarre, the proto-fascist and the drug dealing world. Robert Vesco, after putting together a scam in which he basically stole a company from Bernard Kornfeld, who we'll talk about a little later in the broadcast, Vesco later went on to become involved in a variety of bizarre activities, including gun running and drug smuggling, attempting to bribe the United States government. As a matter of fact, there was intervention on his part at the SEC by William Casey, who was at that time head of the SEC under Nixon. Casey, of course, later was Reagan's campaign manager during the whole setting up of this apparent deal with Iran, and then later head of the CIA, and died suddenly at the time the investigation began.
It should also be noted, too, that Robert Vesco, according to a number of authors, including Jim Hogan of Spooks, Henry Krueger of the Great Heroin Coup, has been linked with, among others, Santos Traficante, a member of what the Christic Institute refers to as the secret team in the arms for drugs merry-go-round that our national security establishment has been involved in for quite some time. And again, in both Radio Free America number 25, and in number 30, we talked about the intersection between Santos Traficante and Robert Vesco and some of Mitchell Worbell's weapons that were being smuggled down to Latin America. So again, bear that Traficante-Vesco connection in mind.
That's right. The two things that need to be remembered, again, the minor thing of his basic theft of IOS, Investors Overseas Corporation, from Bernard Kornfeld. That will come up later in the broadcast, but right now, as Dave said, for our purposes, Vesco's deep and long-lasting links with the secret team people who seem to be most involved in the dealing of drugs, and Vesco's own involvement himself through people like William Casey and others of the Nixon administration in the subversion of justice on the federal level.
Okay, now another interesting connection of Robert Vesco to the Iran-Contra situation emerged just this past week. Reading from the New York Times from this past Friday being December 11th of 1987, for those who eventually hear the program on tape, the following story appeared in the New York Times. Again, New York Times, 12/11/87. This is an AP story, Dateline, Jacksonville, Florida, headline, Vesco, fugitive financier, called co-conspirator in cocaine trial. Robert L. Vesco, the fugitive American financier, was identified today as a co-conspirator in the trial of Carlos Leder Rivas, the reputed leader of a Colombian cocaine smuggling network. In arguing that the testimony of Charles Kame, K-E-H-M, a witness about his conversation with Mr. Vesco was admissible as evidence, United States Attorney Robert Merkle, M-E-R-K-L-E, said the details were, quote, a co-conspirator's testimony, unquote. No further details were immediately available about Mr. Vesco's role in the trial of Mr. Lader. Mr. Merkle has refused to discuss the case outside the courtroom. Mr. Vesco was not named in the Lader indictment, but was mentioned, that's Lader indictment, not Lader indictment. Mr. Vesco was not named in the Lader indictment, but was mentioned by the first witness in the case, George Jung, J-U-N-G, as having a business interest in Norman's Cay, an island in the Bahamas. Mr. Jung also testified that Mr. Lader had said that Mr. Vesco had introduced him to Fidel Castro, the Cuban leader. Mr. Vesco, who is believed to live in Cuba, has been a fugitive from the United States since 1974. He is charged with stealing $224 million from an international investment fund. Mr. Lader is being tried on charges he smuggled 3.3 tons of cocaine into North Florida and Georgia from Colombia by way of Norman's Cay in the Bahamas from 1978 to 1980. Mr. Kame, K-E-H-M, the former manager of a company that owned land on Norman's Cay, said he was threatened several times with death by Mr. Lader and Jack Carlton Reed, a co-defendant, when he refused to leave the island. However, Mr. Kame did leave. Mr. Kame testified that on a trip back to the island to retrieve his furniture, quote, we went to the main dock, and I ran into Robert Vesco, of all people. After he told Mr. Vesco about problems in retrieving his personal property, Kame said, quote, he told me the best advice he could give me was to get off the island and keep my nose out of other people's business, unquote. So the surfacing of the Robert Vesco name in a prominent way with the Medellin cartel is significant for our purposes because, again, in RFAs number 29 and 32, we looked at considerable length at the involvement of the secret team, as the Christic Institute puts it, in the or with the Medellin cartel.
All right, and another name that we just mentioned a few moments ago is going to crop up here. This is an article from the New York Times for Tuesday, December 2nd of 1986. The article is headlined, Swiss Company Calls Dealings Legal. The article is by John Tagliabue, as a special to the New York Times, is datelined Zurich. The chairman of a Swiss finance company, thought to have played a role in the Iran arms deal, said today that his company had done, quote, nothing illegal, nothing outside the activity of a fiduciary company, unquote. The company, Compagnie de Service Fiduciaire S.A., which has its offices in the Champel neighborhood of Geneva, has been linked to plane purchases by Nicaraguan rebels and to the channeling of payments from the Iran arms sales. But the chairman, Jean de Senarclan, a well-known Geneva lawyer, said the company, quote, has a client who asked us to do something according to fiduciary practice. We did nothing extraordinary, he added. Mr. de Senarclan, in a telephone conversation, declined to identify the client or the nature of the request. He said the company would issue a statement Tuesday to explain its role. Information from interviews and sales records indicate that planes were purchased for Nicaraguan rebel groups in 1984 and 1985 from a Georgia company and paid for from accounts of CSF Investments, a Bermuda subsidiary of the Geneva Finance Company. The Times of London, quoting sources familiar with the transaction, said $18 million from the Iran arms sales was paid into the Swiss company's account in the Cayman Islands. Arrangements for the Iran arms payments involve many participants, but it is thought that the Geneva company may have coordinated bank transfers. Mr. de Senarclan refused to comment on these allegations. Swiss commercial records do not reveal ownership, but the finance company has been linked with Albert Hakim, an Iranian businessman living in the United States who is a business partner of Major General Richard V. Secord, a retired Pentagon official linked to the Iran arms sales. Mr. de Senarclan denied that his company was controlled by Mr. Hakim. Quote, he is a client, Mr. de Senarclan said. He also denied that his company had links with the Central Intelligence Agency or other United States government agencies. He said news reports of the transactions involving the company and its units offered, quote, false interpretations, but he would not elaborate. Mr. de Senarclan said he was one of two officials, quote, responsible for the administration of the company, more or less equivalent to board members of an American corporation. He identified the other as Alfred Stoller, a Swiss-German businessman. The company's manager, Willard I. Zucker, Z-U-C-K-E-R, who runs its day-to-day business, has refused to answer questions. On Sunday, Mr. Zucker agreed to accept written questions, though he has not yet answered them. Skipping down. According to Geneva business sources, Mr. Zucker is an American lawyer and longtime resident of Switzerland. It is unclear whether he joined the company at its founding or shortly thereafter. Before joining the company, Mr. Zucker is believed to have worked for Bernard Kornfeld, the American financier who built Investors Overseas Services Limited, a mutual fund, into a multi-billion dollar operation before being forced out in 1970 by Robert Vesco amid charges of mismanagement and fraud that later brought Mr. Kornfeld a jail sentence. Now, something that should be mentioned again to those of you not particularly familiar with these cases, although Bernard Kornfeld was forced out of IOS by Robert Vesco, Bernard Kornfeld, as I recall anyway, Dave, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, already had a history himself of trafficking in some very strange kind of nebulous and shadowy areas, for our purposes, that of gun dealing and things of that nature. And Vesco's forcing him out was perhaps more of a conflict among pirates than anything else.
Just off the top of my head, I can't remember any specific charges against Kornfeld. The IOS connections with the activities talking about that I have memories over all Vesco, but again, I'd have to go back and go over the material per se. But the interesting connection there, though, of Willard Zucker to Investors Overseas Services, which as an institution was looted for espionage purposes by Robert Vesco, is intriguing. And again, we bring this up because the person who was to a large extent framing the questions for the investigators during the congressional hearings was Arthur Lyman, who was a former attorney of Robert Vesco's. His firm has represented, or he has personally represented, Robert Vesco in the past. So in light of Vesco's connections to this, that could very easily represent a possible conflict of interest. It should also be noted, we're going to come back to the Lyman Law Firm. Nip, why don't you save that one article just so we can read the law firm again. Rifkin Weiss are the only two partners I can remember. No, the first one about Arthur Lyman.
Right, okay, yes, it's right here. And the law firm name is Paul Weiss, Rifkin, Wharton, and Garrison.
Well, we'll say that for future reference, because we are going to come back to that law firm, although we're not actually going to read from the incorporation papers. Mae Brussel has the incorporation papers for TCI, the Otto von Bolschwing Electronics Company, one of whose subsidiaries was International Imaging Systems by Albert Hakim, which then jumped to Stanford Technologies, however, and according to one intelligence source quoted in the San Jose Metro, Helena von Damm worked for some Hakim subsidiaries abroad. Again, the Rifkin Law Firm drew up the incorporation papers for TCI, so that's another interesting possible conflict of interest here. Research credit for the following story goes to Mae Brussel, an excellent researcher whose work is featured on this program. It's a very short article from the San Francisco Chronicle of March 11th of 1987. It's titled, Moles on Capitol Hill. There will be moles, unquote, among Senate and House aides investigating the Iran-Contra affair. But it's all above board. Anxious to avoid the rivalries and surprises that beset the Watergate panels, each side will send an agent to the other's offices to keep track of what's happening on the opposite side of the Capitol. So, they intend to have people, in essence, on both sides of the investigation, checking things out, checking each other's situations out, is worth noting here. One of the people who appears to be a mole, although not a particularly underground mole, his situation is fairly above board, is a man named Thomas Polgar. Thomas Polgar is one of the chief investigators for the congressional investigation of the Iran-Contra scandal, and he, like so many of the others, has connections to the very foxes who he is supposedly guarding the hen house against. Research credit for the following story also goes to Mae Brussel. This is from the Washington Post of March 4th for 1987. It's by Dan Morgan and Howard Kurtz, K-U-R-T-Z, of the Washington Post. It's headlined, Iran-Contra probers appoint CIA ex-aide. Thomas Polgar, P-O-L-G-A-R, the Central Intelligence Agency station chief in Saigon when it fell to the communists in 1975, has been appointed an investigator with the Senate Special Panel on the Iran-Contra affair. The appointment was one of a number of staff positions filled in recent days by the Select Committee on Secret Military Assistance to Iran and the Nicaraguan opposition. Last week, the panel named 10 associate counsels to work under Chief Counsel Arthur L. Lyman, L-I-M-A-N. In addition to Polgar, the committee this week appointed Federal Bureau of Investigation veteran David E. Faulkner to its investigative staff. Committee Vice Chairman Senator Warren B. Rudman, Republican of New Hampshire, said yesterday that Polgar will be the committee's resident intelligence expert who, as we're talking to witnesses or looking at intelligence data, will have the experience to determine whether we're being dealt with candidly, unquote. Again, this person interrupting here, this person, Thomas Polgar, is going to be trusted with the responsibility of telling the congressional investigators whether or not they were being lied to. Check out his credentials in that regard. Continuing with the article, Polgar's son is Rudman's legislative director. Rudman said that other members of the special panel, including Chairman Senator Daniel K. Inouye, Democrat of Hawaii, have known him for years. Before retirement in 1981, Polgar's 34-year career with the CIA included duty in Europe, Latin America, Southeast Asia, and Washington, and won him several service medals. It also exposed him to some of the retired intelligence officers and military men whose names have figured in the unfolding accounts of secret meetings with Iranian arms dealers, arms sales, and movement of arms and other aid to the Contras in Nicaragua. One of those was Theodore G. Shackley, whom Polgar replaced in Saigon in 1972, and who then returned to Washington to head the agency's East Asia division. In late 1980, Shackley, then retired, worked as a consultant for a company owned by Albert Hakim, who has been named by the Senate Intelligence Committee as one of those who, according to testimony and documents, played a key role in the Iran initiative and in supplying the Contras. So in addition to the fact that Thomas Polgar succeeded Theodore Shackley at as CIA chief of mission in Saigon and worked with Shackley for a long time, his son is the legislative assistant for Senator Rudman of New Hampshire. So one wonders how candid the assessments were going to be that there were that they received. This, again, we're asking why a lot of this information never came to light. A lot of the stuff that we've talked about did not figure in the final official report.
Yes, and again, there's very little doubt as we go along examining these various foxes why the hen house has not been safe. This article, again, was also supplied to us by Mae Brussel. It is out of In These Times for June 10th to 23rd, 1987. The article is headlined, Congressional Conflict of Interest, a CIA good old boy probes the network. The article is by Vince Bielski and Dennis Bernstein, and the sections that we're going to read are as follows. Upon arriving in Washington for his new job, Polgar, again, the same Thomas Polgar Dave was just telling you about, met with former CIA colleague Donald Gregg, who was an advisor to Vice President George Bush. Gregg is only one of many former Polgar colleagues connected to the Iran-Contra scandal. Just should put in at this point, as an asterisk, Donald Gregg, as we touched on briefly reading the Lewis Traeger article, Donald Gregg not only is George Bush's national security advisor, Donald Gregg is a direct contact to the use of cocaine money in the Contra supply operation through Felix Gonzalez, Max Gonzalez, Felix Rodriguez.
Max Gomez, Felix Rodriguez.
The pseudonyms are getting to me. Yes, Max Gomez, a.k.a. Felix Rodriguez, was met many times with Donald Gregg, George Bush's security advisor.
Don't confuse now Felix Rodriguez with Ramon Millan Rodriguez of the Medellin cartel, although Ramon Millan Rodriguez testified that he gave money to Donald Gregg and talked about the relationship between Felix Rodriguez and Gregg. So it does get confusing.
Indeed. So this is who Thomas Polgar, one of Thomas Polgar's, as he mentions, upon arriving in Washington for his new job, Polgar met with former CIA colleague Donald Gregg. According to the February 23rd Legal Times, Polgar laid out his agenda to Gregg this way, quote, he wanted to assure me that the hearings would not be a repeat of the Pike and Church investigation. Of course, that was the investigation into the CIA's misdeeds. Even the Church Committee only scraped the surface, but at least they began to talk about some things like assassination. At least they talked about them, which is more than has been done in the Iran-Contra investigation. A clear sign that House Senate panelists are not headed in that direction is the blackout at the hearings of the 1984 terrorist bombing in La Penca, Nicaragua. At a press conference, eight people, including an American reporter, were killed during the blast intended to kill Aiden Pastora, the renegade Contra leader. Yet, evidence recently uncovered links the terrorist scheme to a CIA operative who, according to the Tower Report, was a close associate of Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North in the arms network. Nor has the evidence of the CIA's complicity in drug trafficking been addressed at the hearings. Several of the Contra supporters linked to La Penca are also allegedly key players in the cocaine trade based in Costa Rica. For now, Congress has drawn a bottom line and buried La Penca beneath it. This blackout appears to have been helped along by Polgar. The man who used to fool Capitol Hill is now helping it fool itself. By the way, the reference to helping to fool Capitol Hill is the fact that Thomas Polgar, as CIA station chief in Vietnam, following Theodore Shackley, spent a great deal of his time giving false reports to Congress about the actual state of affairs in Vietnam. Whether or not the longtime CIA operative could conduct a fair investigation of a scandal replete with CIA illegalities was apparently never a question for Senator Warren Rudman, Republican of New Hampshire, the vice chair of the Senate panel. Rudman told the press that the panel members needed an intelligence expert to guide them through the complex probe of a covert operation, and he handpicked Polgar for the job. The fact that Polgar's son is Rudman's legislative aide didn't hurt Polgar's chances for selection. Skipping down, Polgar's appointment to the Senate panel creates undeniable conflict of interest issues. He is an active member of the Association of Former Intelligence Officers, AFIO, an organization that expends considerable energy lobbying Congress on behalf of U.S. intelligence activities. He served as a consultant to the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism, a home port for several figures in the Iran-Contra scandal. He is a paid consultant for a corporate risk analysis firm that had ties to ex-Nicaraguan dictator Anastasio Somoza. And as CIA chief of station in Vietnam, Polgar worked for Theodore Shackley, a former top CIA official who facilitated arms sales to Iran. Shackley is also a defendant in the Christic Institute suit. Skipping down. Because of his accent and his past, by the way, Polgar is originally from Hungary, Polgar always considered himself an outsider in the CIA's ivory-covered bureaucracy, unquote, wrote Frank Snepp, a former colleague of Polgar's and an intelligence analyst in Vietnam. He overcame his personal insecurities with extra effort and faith in then-Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, whose, quote, personality was as important to him as his politics, Snepp wrote, for Kissinger's own accent and past were proof to Polgar that outsiders could triumph in the elite world of American democracy. Well, indeed, Thomas Polgar, as an outsider with an accent, has apparently triumphed because the very things that he wanted to prevent, as he said to Donald Gregg, namely any sort of Pike and Church Committee investigation sort of surfacing regarding the Iran-Contra case, has in fact come to fruition. There has been no such investigation. No such information has come out. And Polgar's contacts, Theodore Shackley, the firm that used to represent Anastasio Somoza and all, can rest very easily knowing Thomas Polgar is on the job.
It's also interesting that he looked up to Henry Kissinger. Henry Kissinger has many, many connections to this investigation slash cover-up. We'll be getting into those shortly. One of the most significant appointments that was made during the course of the Iran-Contra investigation, or alleged investigation, was that of Frank Carlucci first to be head of the National Security Council and later Secretary of Defense, which he is now. Reading from the Wall Street Journal of Friday, January 9th of 1987, the research credit for this also, by the way, goes to Mae Brussel. This is from the Wall Street Journal again, 1987. It's an article by Jonathan Quitney, headlined, New NSC Chief's Ties to Men Cited in Iran Crisis. Illegal arms deal may cloud... what do you think this word is, the headline? May cloud...
Horizon?
Horizon, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Illegal arms deals may cloud horizon, of course. Dateline Washington, it reads as follows. Frank Charles Carlucci III, who became President Reagan's fifth national security advisor last Friday, has already ordered wholesale staff changes, and friends who have long enjoyed his loyalty predict he'll cleanse the National Security Council in the wake of the Iran-Contra arms scandal. No one has challenged his integrity. If there's a shadow on Mr. Carlucci's house-cleaning prospects, however, it is... his old loyalties he has shown to members of a circle that seems deeply involved in the same shadowy world of overseas arms sales and secret dealings that has been exposed in the Iran-Contra scandal. They are former associates of Edwin Wilson, the former U.S. intelligence operative who amassed tens of millions of dollars by illegally selling U.S. arms, explosives, and expertise to Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi and others. Mr. Wilson is now serving a 52-year federal sentence for weapons exports and for conspiracy to murder at least 10 people, including two federal prosecutors. Carlucci says he has never met Mr. Wilson and doesn't believe in guilt by association. But he acknowledges investing great faith in two men who have associated with Mr. Wilson and who have been linked to, though never formally charged with, a plot to steal taxpayers' money on arms shipments to Egypt. 3 years ago, the Justice Department declined to prosecute the two men, Major General Richard Secord and Eric von Marbod, who have steadfastly protested their innocence. By various accounts, both were occasional visitors to Mr. Wilson's $4 million Virginia estate while he was still a $32,000 a year civil servant, and continued friendly relations with him after he was relieved from his naval intelligence job. General Richard Secord regularly used Mr. Wilson's private plane and had an investment transaction with him. In a recent interview, Mr. Carlucci confirmed that as Deputy Defense Secretary in 1982, he overrode the Pentagon's general counsel and personally rescued General Secord's career when the general was suspended because of a grand jury investigation into his dealings with Mr. Wilson. General Secord wasn't indicted, but he later resigned his senior Pentagon post after newspapers reported his Wilson ties. Some current and former law enforcement officials who were active in the Egyptian arms investigation are still furious over Mr. Carlucci's reinstatement of General Secord in 1982. Now, General Secord has become a focal point of the current scandal surrounding Mr. Reagan's National Security Council, the house Mr. Carlucci is assigned to clean. General Secord reportedly has been involved in both supplying equipment to the Nicaraguan rebels and in aiding NSC officials in the covert shipment of arms to Iran. Twice last month, he invoked his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination in refusing to testify before congressional committees probing the arms sales and Contra money. But it is to Mr. von Marbod that Mr. Carlucci has the closest ties. Mr. von Marbod was the Pentagon's chief arms sales official until he resigned, asserting health reasons while under investigation in the Egyptian arms scandal. Although it was determined that that the transactions Mr. von Marbod had approved had led to massive abuses, it was decided here that it was decided there was too little information to charge him with criminal misconduct. When Mr. Carlucci left the Defense Department in 1982 to become president of Sears World Trade, the Sears Roebuck & Company unit that is now closing its doors, he brought Mr. von Marbot along as a $2,000-a-year consultant. Roderick M. Hills, former chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission and the original chairman of Sears World Trade, who left it in 1984, says, quote, "Eric von Marbot was at least chief of staff for Frank. Eric read all his mail, answered all questions, went to all meetings," unquote. Susan Clow, C-L-O-U-G-H, Mr. Carlucci's executive assistant at Sears World Trade and a former personal secretary to President Carter, says Mr. von Marbot was one of the three people most influential with Mr. Carlucci, the other being his wife and former defense secretary Donald Rumsfeld. "Yes, I listened to him," Mr. Carlucci responds, laughing. Mr. von Marbot, now a representative of LTV Corporation in Europe, hasn't returned telephone calls. The relationship of Mr. Wilson, General Secord, Mr. von Marbot, and former CIA officer Thomas Kleins was reported by the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post in October of 1982. The Journal story concerned a 1979 Egyptian arms deal that later resulted in $10,000 in criminal fines paid by a holding company headed by Mr. Kleins, and the repayment of $3 million of an alleged $8 million in illegal profits made by Egyptian American Transport and Services Corporation, or EATSCO. The profits came from an arms shipping contract approved by Mr. von Marbot while at the Pentagon. General Secord also oversaw some aspects of the Egyptian arms sales. EATSCO was co-founded by Mr. Kleins, who also has played a role in the secret National Security Council dealings with Iran. Mr. Kleins used funds borrowed from Mr. Wilson to establish EATSCO. Manhunt, last year's best-selling book about Mr. Wilson by Peter Maas, contained charges that all four men owned stock in a trading company that invested, through Mr. Kleins' holding company, in a major chunk of EATSCO. All but Mr. Wilson have denied this, and General Secord's lawyer, Thomas Green, complained it was an outrageous accusation, unquote, without a shred of reliable evidence, unquote. The book's publisher, Random House, has refused his demand for a retraction. According to 1979 correspondence between Mr. Wilson, his lawyer, and Mr. Kleins' lawyer, which Mr. Maas made available to the Journal, Mr. Wilson expected an ownership share in the trading company. A January 18, 1979 memo from Mr. Wilson's lawyer says stock will be owned by four individual U.S. citizens, unquote, but doesn't name them. Mr. Wilson's bookkeeper and companion, Roberta Barnes, told the Justice Department that Mr. Wilson had identified Messrs. von Marbot and Kleins and General Secord as in on the deal. She and Messrs. Wilson and von Marbot and General Secord met over dinner in London late that January. During the subsequent investigation, Mr. Kleins denied he had any partners besides the Egyptian with whom he started the company, and the Justice Department decided it couldn't prove otherwise. Mr. Carlucci says he first met Mr. von Marbot when he was proposed for the Pentagon arms job. Mr. Carlucci was so impressed, he says, that he battled the Joint Chiefs of Staff to make the appointment. They had wanted a military officer in the job. A year after Mr. von Marbot resigned, he followed Mr. Carlucci to Sears.
And we're going to talk a little bit more about Mr. Carlucci. Reading from an article originally printed Tuesday, November 3rd, 1987.
Actually, maybe we should recap just a bit before we go on to that article.
Okay.
The point there being, of course, and we've dealt with that article before, that Frank Carlucci, in fact, is very much an intimate of many of the members of the Tropa Wilson team that we looked at in RFA 30. Again, in Radio Free America number 4, we introduced our listeners to the Tropa Wilson team in archival form. Then in Radio Free America number 30, we took a look at how the Iran-Contra scandal involves the Tropa Wilson team, that they being the main element involved in the Contra support effort. Obviously, Frank Carlucci is intimate with many of the people from that team.